is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, June 27, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. Tara Mandarano is a writer and editor based in Ontario who lives with chronic pain. Today on Rabble Radio, she shares her story about living with fibromyalgia and endometriosis as a single mother. Here she is in conversation with Rabble publisher Sarah Sahagian. Take a listen.
Tara is somebody that I've known for a really long time. She is a beautiful writer. She also writes quite poignantly about the topic specifically of chronic pain. And that's what we're going to discuss today, living with chronic pain and what that's like in Canada. Obviously, we cannot encompass everybody's experiences within the realm of this particular chat, but I thought it was worth having this conversation, and Tara speaks and writes so beautifully about it. So I wanted to talk to her today. Welcome, Tara.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
So let's start with it. How long have you been suffering from chronic pain? And can you describe the kind of pain, to the extent that you're able, because I know pain is often indescribable, that you live with?
Sure. So I've been diagnosed with two chronic pain conditions. One of them was fibromyalgia, which I was diagnosed with when I was 31. So I'm in my late 40s now, so quite a long time ago. And the other one was endometriosis, which I've basically had, in my opinion, I guess, since I was an adolescent, I guess you would say from 11 or 12, but it really didn't manifest in my life in a big way until I reached my 20s. Both of those conditions, they're very different in terms of how they present and manifest in the body, but they're very similar in that they mainly affect women. So that's something that kind of comes up a lot when you talk about chronic pain in Canada and every other country in the world, is that unfortunately, women or people that are assigned female at birth are often afflicted with these conditions that don't necessarily have a lot of research or funding when it comes to figuring out ways to treat them or develop new medications, that type of thing. So it can be really frustrating as a woman dealing with something like either of those health conditions or any of the other ones that people may have out there and learning how to cope with it on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I really admire about you is how candidly you write about the way that your chronic pain, which is something that, I mean, we know is not inevitable. We know that there just isn't enough research about women's health conditions, as you just explained. I love how vulnerable you are in your writing. So if it's okay, I just want to read part of your piece, "Today Will Disappoint My Daughter." Could I read that for our audience?
Sure, go ahead.
So this is a post that you did on May 29th. And so a lot of Tara's writing is free and available to the public through Instagram, where you have a huge following. And here's how the piece starts. "Today, I will disappoint my daughter. I will feel like the worst mother in the world. I will text her dad closer to the time her school fun fair starts this evening and tell him I can't make it. I will not be able to speak to her directly. She will be at a friend's house and with no phone. She will be momentarily disappointed when she finds out, but not surprised. I am the sick mom in her eyes. She barely remembers the years when pain didn't claim my body and steal me away from her. But I do. So much time lost, and it makes me incredibly, infuriatingly fucking angry and sad and guilty, especially on days like this, when I've been flaring most of the week and the weather is so changeable and wreaks havoc on my parasympathetic nervous system. People who live with chronic pain conditions rarely talk about the bone-deep loneliness of laying in a dark room by yourself, sobbing quietly. No one sees it. The loneliness is killer. I have my cats for comfort, but no partner. At times like this, it's as if I don't exist. It breaks my heart that I won't be able to stand around my daughter's school grounds tonight and watch her run around laughing with her friends, see her getting her face painted or eating ice cream. I emailed the school to see if they had any seating options for parents with mobility issues. I simply cannot, for 2 hours straight, stand with a curb my only option for relief. So it goes on, and you can read the full thing at Tara's Instagram page. But what I think is so beautiful about that and so upsetting is that we know medical research isn't comprehensive enough, that they're not doing enough work to find the answers. How does that make you feel as somebody who advocates for chronic pain sufferers, but also is a chronic pain sufferer yourself?
It makes me feel incredibly angry. It also makes me feel unbearably sad on those days where it is a high pain day. Mm-hmm. And it does affect my life and my family in such a personal way. It's one thing being a solo mother to be on your own and have a high pain day and deal with that and kind of just feel isolated. It's a completely different proposition when you have family commitments. You have a daughter, in my case, who's 11 years old. She's excited. She wants to show me a bit of her world, her school, her day-to-day life. And then I have to disappoint her, like I said in my post, and not even be able to speak to her directly to try to explain. It's just maddening. And it's something that I've learned to live with, I guess, over the last 20 odd years with different chronic pain conditions. But when you add a child into the equation, you add the role of motherhood into the equation, it's a completely different scenario. It raises up so many issues that women already grapple with when it comes to motherhood, such as guilt. So you add something like, you know, not being able to go to that type of school function, and that just kind of doubles that inherent, you know, mom guilt that you would feel on a regular basis, just that kind of is free floating in the air. So it's really just, sometimes I feel resigned to it. And then other times when I speak to other women in the community that are still waiting on a diagnosis, even for their, for their pain, they don't know what's going on with their body, but it's affecting their lives, their career, their relationships, their marriage. Uh-huh. It makes me really angry for them that the wait times in a country like we live in, with a relatively good, you know, compared to other places, health system, is still so lacking. And it's actually, in the world of endometriosis, which I've been a part of for a long time, it has actually gotten extremely worse in the last few years when it comes to even being able to book an appointment with a gynecologist. Extremely long waiting list, never mind if you're trying to get something like a surgery to actually try and treat the condition. So it's frustrating that there's this level of inequality, that it's, you know, underreported, it's underidentified, and just the repercussions that chronic pain has for women that men don't necessarily go through when it comes to this. It's just so unfair.
And approximately 20% of Canadian women, it's estimated, live with chronic pain. And there are definitely men who live with chronic pain in Canada, but the number is much lower. So it is really, chronic pain is, as you said, a gendered problem. It really is that. So I know that you're really excited about something that is going to start soon. Tell me about your ketamine trial and how you decided to get involved with that.
Basically, what happens sometimes in the chronic pain community, especially for women with endometriosis, after a certain number of surgeries, if they're not quote unquote successful, and you've been operated on a number of times, which is often the case, and the pain or the disease comes back, you're often sort of find yourself at the end of the road as a woman in the medical community. And then you're sort of transferred, referred, or like shipped off to a pain management program, you know, at a various hospital or clinic. And that's what happened in my case a few years ago. I had a surgery. It didn't alleviate my pain the way that I thought it would, unfortunately.
And was this for endometriosis?
Yes, it was for endometriosis. And then sort of what no one talks about is the after effects and legacy of something like endometriosis, which can involve things like scar tissue. adhesions. You have something like a hysterectomy, your organs can start sticking together. There's lots of stuff that can happen even after the endo is technically taken out. So I was seeing a pain specialist for the last, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. And she, you know, has had me try different treatments, things like nerve blocks and different medications. And then, you know, she's been very proactive. She's a woman herself. She's like the top pelvic pain specialist in the city of Toronto. So to her credit, she has always been looking for different ways and different suggestions and ideas for me to try to alleviate this because she knows how much it impacts my life. So at the beginning of this year, she referred me to a different pain clinic at a different hospital that were offering ketamine treatments. And this is, I mean, ketamine has been around for a long time for different various uses, but this particular hospital has been offering this treatment for about 15 years, but I would say it hasn't really surfaced like into the public perception probably until the last couple of years or so. So what it exactly entails is going down for one day and being infused with ketamine, you know, through an IV, for six hours, which is a long time, at a strong enough dose that the idea and the hope and the theory behind it is that it sort of resets your parasympathetic nervous system and that your body sort of overreacting to the pain signals and the different things that go along with chronic pain, that that's sort of kind of set back to what a person that doesn't have chronic pain would experience. So it's happening at the end of this month. It was a big decision to undergo this because it's, you know, definitely a completely different kind of treatment that I've had before, conventional medications and surgeries. But at this stage in my life with my daughter, you know, being a preteen and being responsible for my financial situation and paying a mortgage, I figured, what have I got to lose at this point? And if there's a chance that the pain is not, you know, necessarily cured, but is lessened or there's partial relief, it's worth it to me.
Absolutely. So I'm wondering, when you decide to go through something like this, which is not necessarily as common as other treatments for pain might be, what are some of the risks that they tell you about?
I attended an information session a couple of weeks ago, and the main risks or side effects that you can go through during the procedure, like I said, which lasts quite a long time, are things that would happen that you might expect during some kind of a psychedelic experience. So you might, you know, see, you know, colors and shapes. That's kind of the mild end of the spectrum. There's also, because your mind is involved in terms of interacting with the ketamine, you could have old memories come up from the past. You could just sort of think there's things happening that's not anything you might kind of expect along those lines. You might have some anxiety. You're also screened for mental health issues before you're accepted into the treatment to see if you have support for anything like along those lines, if you're able to cope. So it's definitely, I mean, they always have to give you a list of everything that's, you know, potentially could be an issue. But in terms of risks or serious side effects after getting the treatment, I've been reassured that there really hasn't been any serious adverse effects. The one thing that they just can't promise you is that it's going to work. So the one-day trial is basically a test. And I asked in the session, what if your one-day trial, a month afterwards, when they follow up with you, you don't feel significant relief or any relief, what happens then? And that's basically it. That's kind of the end of the road. So it's a bit daunting, you know, thinking as someone who's gone through and lived with chronic pain for so many years, you really putting a lot of hope into this and thinking, I hope this works not just for me, but for my daughter who lives with me and wants me to be more present and active, for my immediate and extended family who have seen the repercussions over the years of chronic pain. So I'm trying to balance my expectations and manage my expectations, but it's just sort of an unknown. The good news is if it does work and I do get relief from that one-day trial, there is an option then to get more treatments in the future.
And how often would you have to get those treatments?
It all depends on the person. So some people get a one-day treatment and they could see pain relief that lasts for months or a year. Other people get them intermittently, so every few months, and they kind of top up, I guess you would say. And then there's also the option, which I was originally presented with, of getting 5 treatments 5 days in a row, which is pretty, you know, kind of hardcore. So that's also
for 6 hours each?
Yes.
Oh, 30 hours in 1 week.
Yes.
Okay.
So that is pretty intense. And that's, you know, a case obviously where you need someone, you know, to be with you and drive you home and stick around overnight and that kind of thing, just to make sure everything's all right. So that was a little more daunting, to be honest, to kind of think of doing that all one batch 5 days in a row. But I'm glad that they offer the option of just doing it for one day and seeing how it goes, whether you tolerate it, whether it has any impact or not.
And how are you preparing for your ketamine treatment?
Practically, there's things that I hadn't thought of, like making a 6-hour playlist of like calm, relaxing music, because it's not like a private room that you'd be getting the treatment in. You're sort of in a room with other people. There's privacy curtains, but you could still hear stuff going on. So for this, for that element and the element of just keeping yourself in a good mental, emotional space, they've advised, you know, creating a playlist, you know, bringing a sleep mask, bringing your favorite blanket, those kind of practical things. And then psychologically and mentally, it's just, like I said, trying to just keep in mind that it's another option, another treatment. And if it works or provides any relief to me, it's worth it. And if it doesn't, I know that I would probably be disappointed, but I'm also trying to work on hopefully not being too disheartened if it isn't the treatment for me.
I mean, it sounds like living with chronic pain requires you to constantly be managing your expectations.
Yes, that's the thing, because you wake up every day and you don't know how you're going to feel. That's the thing with, especially with a condition like fibromyalgia, which is very dependent for me, at least, on the weather and changing weather patterns. So it is a lot of management, and it's a lot of also not just emotional labor, but just energy labor in terms of, you know, setting up appointments, going to these sessions, having conversations with family about what it involves, trying to explain what it actually is to my daughter, who, you know, that's a big thing to wrap your head around when you're a kid. You know, it seems all she hears is the word hospital. You know, it can be a little bit frightening, or what's going to happen. But like I said, I'm willing to try it, because nothing else has really worked in a sustainable way. And being on strong dose painkillers sort of for the rest of my life is not ideal.
And what's it like being on strong dose painkillers? How often do you have to use them, and what is that like?
To be honest with you, I pretty much need to use them, I would say, every day. It's something that allows me to function and get up in the morning, get out of bed, get my daughter off to school, do work, go about my day. Like I mentioned, I'm a single mother. I don't have a partner. So everything that happens in terms of things around the house is down to me. So without them, and if I was just taking, you know, regular over-the-counter stuff, I don't think I would be able to do all that. And opioids, as we know, have gone through some periods in recent years where they've gotten a really bad rap, because unfortunately, addiction has just sort of become associated with them to the degree that people often forget what they were originally invented for and the relief that they offer so many people with chronic pain. So it's not ideal. And I'm on kind of the weakest one there is, but I have had to increase my dose over the years. And it gets to the point where it's like, how often do you want to do that? And how often will your doctor even allow that? You know, because the guidelines and the rules around that have become so strict that it's really only a pain medication doctor that is going to be able to approve that. And then a family doctor can manage it, but it's only through the express prescription of a specialist.
Well, we want to wish you best of luck in your ketamine trial. We really hope that it goes well. I'm sure all of our listeners feel that way. Thank you so much, Tara, for taking the time to speak to us about your experiences and what it's like living with chronic pain as a woman in Canada. I know that we can't reflect all experiences with one interview, but I really admire how you get the conversation started on your Instagram page. So please tell our listeners, where can they find your beautiful writing about a variety of topics, not just chronic pain, although you do write quite poignantly about chronic pain, of course.
Thank you. Well, they can find me, and I'd love to hear from them and hear their stories on my Instagram page or account at just under Tara Mandarano. I also have a blog, which is taramandarano.com. And yeah, feel free to reach out or let me know if you have any questions or want to share your own experience, because that's the reason that I do write. It's not just for myself and for my own therapy. It's to bring awareness and also share different information pieces, you know, with other people that are going through the same thing. So if anyone is out there listening and they feel like they're the only one going through it, or no one understands in their immediate family or friend circle, there are people out there that do exactly know what you're going through.
That's an important reminder. Thank you, Tara. Have a lovely day.
Thank you.
Was Tara Mandarano in conversation with Rabble publisher Sarah Sahagian. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us, Tara. And now this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. For that, let's go over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with world news. A ceasefire is holding after the US and Israel spent 12 days attacking different parts of Iran with bombs and missiles. Peace advocates around the world condemn the acts of aggression against Iran, which Israel and the US say were aimed at Iran's nuclear facilities. Hundreds of Iranians were killed, with an estimate 29 killed on the Israeli side. On June 22nd, the US bombed purported nuclear sites in Iran. The NDP, as well as organizations advocating for peace, called on Prime Minister Mark Carney to condemn these acts of aggression against a fellow United Nations member. Instead, Carney applauded the actions of the US. Staying in world news, the annual NATO summit took place this week in the Netherlands. At that meeting, Carney pledged to abide by the military alliance's goal to have member nations spend 5% of their gross domestic product on their armed forces. At this summit, NATO actually increased the spending commitment they were asking of their member states from 2% to 5%. This expenditure would cost Canada over $150 billion and would see cuts from other areas of the federal budget, including social programs. Also this week, Rabble columnist Charlotte Sheesby shares their story of choosing to be openly transgender in a time of rising hate against her community. June is Pride Month, and Sheesby discusses their journey as a transgender woman, as well as persevering at a time when far-right elected officials are persecuting the queer community. Sheesby describes facing adversity with joy, and not just by celebrating and showing pride in the present, but by having pride in the past as well. Sheesby writes, quote, "We queers dance amidst the graves of those who danced before us, because we know that their ghosts dance with us. To be queer is to inhabit a memory and a lineage that started before our own dance began, and that will continue after our dance ends. It is not to shun death, not exactly. Rather, it is to embrace a life that only has meaning because loss circumscribes its boundaries." End quote. In Alberta politics this week, Alberta NDP leader Naheed Nenshi faced the first real test of his leadership as the province held three by-elections. Nenshi handily won his first seat in the provincial legislature by winning the Edmonton-Strathcona by-election. The NDP also retained another seat in the riding of Edmonton-Ellerslie. While the ruling United Conservative Party also did retain a seat in the third by-election in the riding of Olds, Didsbury, and Three Hills, the separatist Republican Party failed to even reach third place in that race. The separatists had been hoping for a respectable showing in all three by-elections, but failed to secure many votes. Alberta politics expert David Kleimenhage points to this result as a lack of an appetite for a referendum on separation in the province. And finally, David Suzuki is reminding everyone that while some insects might be considered pests, they are important to our ecosystem. Insects like the fruit fly, beetles, and the housefly can be a good indicator of the health of the local environment. Climate change is killing many species of insect, and the effects are being seen further up the food chain. A 2019 study by Cornell University found that the U.S. had around 3 million fewer birds than it did in 1970, and that many of these species fed on insects. Suzuki calls for the protection of insects by shifting to clean energy and restoring green spaces. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca. And thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain. CJ.